BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In 1979, the waspish East Anglian journalist and ghost hunter, James Wentworth Day, wrote that Essex is becoming the dustbin of London. What for him was an invasion was, for many thousands of families who were leaving behind the slums or blitz streets of East London, a hopeful exodus and an opportunity for a fresh start in life, gilded by a prospect of the sea. With the longest coastline of any English county apart from Cornwall, 5 major rivers and dozens of small islands, Essex has always offered an escape route to a better life, where there is a place to live, work or play. I was 6 years old when my family moved from Leytonstone to Canvey Island in 1950, where opportunities for work as a carpenter, which my father was, were plentiful in the post-war building boom. We rented a small bungalow in Grafton Road, a mud and shingle lane only a few hundred yards from the sea wall, one of thousands of jerry-built dwellings in what was still frontier territory. These plotland settlements, as they were called, had grown out of late Victorian land speculation schemes. Large areas of cheap agricultural land were purchased in coastal Essex and subdivided into hundreds of small lots for resale to Londoners, to be developed as holiday chalets or permanent residences, many self-built. Ours was a wooden cabin, fronted by a veranda, standing on brick piers about 15 inches off the ground, just high enough for a child to crawl under, which, of course, I did. Every dwelling in Grafton Road was different, often eccentrically so, and the surrounding streets possessed an unplanned, ramshackle character. At carnival time, islanders dressed in Dutch costume. Many street names, Vetso Road, Zyder Road, Delft Road and Kammerdyke Avenue, reinforced the connection with the 17th century Dutch engineers who had reclaimed the land from the sea. Just a few miles further up the coast, on Foulness Island, women islanders wore Dutch costume until the First World War. Traces of the original Plotland bungalows can still be found, their story commemorated at the Plotland Museum in Leyndon. We moved to the mainland 2 years later, only months before the catastrophic flood of January the 31st, 1953, when a rogue tide swept the east coast, leaving 307 dead and 32,000 homeless from King's Lynn to Canning Town. In the Netherlands, nearly 2,000 people died. A treacherous mix of weather conditions funneling down the North Sea resulted in a tidal surge some 2 metres higher than usual, breaching the seawalls of East Anglia and reducing the flat, largely arable coastline to a vast floodplain. 59 people lost their lives on Canvey alone, and 13,000 were evacuated. Many perished from exposure, perched on the roofs of their houses waiting in the dark, lashed by wind and water, dressed only in their night clothes. Once the flood had subsided, bodies were collected from hedgerows and ditches and laid out on the pavement for identification. A fireman remembered laying out a row of 18 corpses on a Canvey pavement. They were all people I actually knew. You can't imagine what it was like, he told a local newspaper. My parents knew some of them too. The island was so different from London, it could well have been another country. In earlier times, Canvey had been promoted as an ideal health resort and as an exotic place to live, easily reached by train, surrounded by sea, and conspicuously flat, it was perfect for walking, cycling and swimming. Cheap accommodation was found in chalets, caravans and guest houses, one of which was the Girls' Bungalow Holiday Home. This was established in 1909 by Clara Grace James, trade union founder of the Working Girls at Play Network of women's clubs in London. James raised enough money to build a holiday retreat for young women working long hours in the East End sweatshops. Archive photographs show an extended clapboard building where young women in long skirts and blouses pose on a rustic veranda or stand smiling in the bosky gardens as if in a Chekhov play. Like the cherry orchard, however, the former gardens have disappeared beneath new housing. Cycling down Grafton Road last summer, so much had changed. The former Plotland bungalows had been extended or rebuilt completely, gussied up as superior suburban chalets with picture windows, carriage lamps, paved front gardens and carports with bright patio planting. Many residents had worked at the nearby oil refineries or at Ford's car factories in Dagenham and Basildon. But Canby's now long-established population is ageing sedately and gracefully. Its former industrial punk aesthetic, courtesy of Dr. Feelgood, today more Sunset Boulevard. There was a temperance hotel on Canby called Ozonia in Seaview Road. Its somewhat bizarre appearance still lodged in my memory. The designer was Ernest George Trowbridge, a Swedenborgian Christian and architect of eclectic originality. The building was a dramatic confection of irregular thatched roofing, eyebrow eaves, dormer windows and shingled balconies, all uncertainly combined to produce a structure that was part gingerbread house, part mock Tudor mansion. Guest rooms were decorated with murals. Some were dream landscapes. Others pictured nightmarish portraits of hellfire and serpents, intended to remind guests of the perils of drink. It was eventually demolished in the 1960s. Since the 19th century, evangelical religion and social reform movements have linked the back streets of the East End to many other parts of coastal Essex. In 1891, William Booth's Salvation Army established the Hadley Farm Colony, where, over the following decades, homeless men could recover their health and find God and salvation. For more than 100 years, thousands have come and gone at the colony, which still thrives, not all needing now quite so much religion today, perhaps. In adapting to new social needs, the farm is now run on organic principles and trains young women and men with learning disabilities in catering skills. OC Island, near Maldon, one of the county's smallest inhabited islands on the River Blackwater, was where Frederick Nicholas Charrington, the conscience-stricken scion of the brewing family, established another rehabilitation settlement in 1903, this time for a rather higher class of alcoholics, and it was still being used as retreat until recently. Early patients included Walter Sickert. One of its last was Amy Winehouse. Closer to the Blackwater estuary, and in view of Mersey Island, walkers today will come across a more recent retreat, the Othona community, established in 1946 by RAF Padre Norman Motley. It was to act as a hallowed place where British and German Christians could meet in a spirit of reconciliation following the horrors of the Second World War. And it still flourishes today, a quiet place where hundreds of visitors, including school parties, find sanctuary each year amongst the creeks and marshlands. Motley followed a pattern common to many other religious and political idealists who shaped the Essex communitarian tradition. Born into a large working-class family in East London, he was a member of the choir at St John of Jerusalem in Hackney, an avid student of religion and music, and he taught evening classes from an early age. "Faith without works is barren" was a favourite text for his sermons. In his memoir, he recalled the day in March 1946 when he and his wife drove to Bradwell to see the isolated site that was to become the location of his great experiment, perfectly situated next to the 7th century St Peter's Chapel. St Peter's is situated a few hundred yards from the south shores of the river, at the point where it enters the North Sea, he wrote. "There one can breathe. The cry of the curlew was heard, and a variety of maritime flora and many seabirds were evident on the saltings. And withal, a great silence." Starting out in a collection of old army huts, Othona now occupies a small off-grid settlement in a collection of portable buildings, teepees and permanent structures. 2 years ago, I helped organise a residential writer's workshop at Othona as part of the annual Essex Book Festival. We were all struck by the kindness and enthusiasm of the staff and volunteers at the settlement, with its polychrome medley of buildings, vegetable gardens and orchards blossoming forth beneath high estuary skies. Whether one chooses to call Othona a retreat, an elective community, or an alternative way of living, and Motley himself spoke of the needs for cells of good living, All such descriptions suggest the need for spaces that act as a counterweight to life in the restless city. Wild Essex, as some call it, has provided such places in plenty. Whether for those religious in intent, communalistic, or those seeking a new relationship to the land and its more mindful stewardship, a pressing issue in an age of environmental anxiety. The writer Sylvia Townsend-Woolner likewise recognised the distilled spiritual air of the Essex marshlands, and in July 1922 bought a map of the county. Intrigued by the blue creeks and the wide expanses of green marshland displayed on her charts, she took a train to Shoeburyn Ness one bank holiday and started walking. Nearing the Blackwater estuary, she had an epiphany. I knew that mysterious sensation of being where I wanted to be and as I wanted to be, socketed in the universe. This is exactly what we all felt during our stay at Othona, a palpable sense of coming home. Woolner also chanced upon the peculiar people, a nonconformist sect unique to Essex, later fictionalised in her novel The True Heart. In the 1920s, the Peculiars had more than 50 chapels in rural Essex and exercised a stiffening resolve on local life and culture, refusing to use doctors and, more controversially, refusing to fight wars, though eventually they were absorbed back into the mainstream nonconformist congregation. One book captures the once lawless marshlands more than any other, in my opinion. Arthur Morrison's Cunning Morel, first published in 1900. I would call it a cult novel, except I seem to be the only person to have read it. A story of white witchcraft in Hadley, Essex, it was based on a real-life savant whose fame extended across the county. I'm usually resistant to ghost stories about marsh spirits, hauntings, devil worship, and tumble-down cottages located at the crossroads, but I'd make an exception for Morrison's novel. Some of its descriptive passages, of the countryside at night, of rural fairs, along with the convincing transcription of dialect speech, are as vivid and heartfelt as the best of Thomas Hardy. Time and again I am struck by how many people tell me they hadn't realised how mystical and alluring the Essex landscape is at its watery edges. The symbiotic relationship between East London and the outer reaches of Essex continues as strong as ever. In my copy of Booth's pioneering 1890 book on how to tackle poverty, In Darkest England and the Way Out, the beautiful colour frontispiece plate depicts a rainbow arching over a farm colony close to the sea. The move from the city to the coast was thus a move from darkness into light. For the past 100 years, Londoners have made this journey to the Essex coast, including, most recently, a group of Orthodox Jewish families moving from North London to Canvey Island, hoping to establish a community there. For many today, the weather still brightens from the east.